Okay, good evening to everyone. L'chol ha'mazinim. Tonight we discuss part 13 of the Law and the Law, sponsored by Becky and Avi Katzel, Ilan Ishmas Yonah ben Rab Arye Leib. Tonight's topic is the case of Brandenburg versus Ohio and the Torah's view of free speech. So we have addressed the issue of free speech in a number of contexts, the defamation or censorship, but not yet in one that's considered fundamental to the American personality and ethos, and that is political speech, the right to criticize the government and live to talk about it, actually to live freely and talk about it, the right to poke fun at the leadership, to mock them incessantly. Now, this was almost unheard of when it was adopted as the cornerstone of the First Amendment. It's still not widely embraced across the world, obviously not in dictatorships, but even in democracies. Even in Israel, for example, there's a law still in the books and enforced sporadically against insulting a public official. It's section 288 of the Penal Code, insulting a public official. Now, you'd think it happens on a daily basis, especially in the Knesset. Well, in the Knesset, they're immune from prosecution because of their status. But an outside person, a layman who insults a public official, it's been applied the last couple of years to people who attack the Supreme Court. In the United States, insulting a public official is a profession for some, it's a hobby for all, and in fact it's a staple of comedians. But just what is the extent of the First Amendment's statement? Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. So are there no limits at all? Can a person say anything at any time, even though words matter? Words matter. Words influence, and they provoke and even stir rebellion. Thank you very much. Let's see if it works. It's interesting that we're accustomed to almost unlimited free speech today, but it wasn't always like that in American life, even recently, and the changes are not only due to the anti-authority streak of the 60s and 70s, but and the distrust and sometimes abhorrence of government it engendered, but also because of our case, Brandenburg versus Ohio, which set the standard that we follow today. How we got to Brandenburg tells a fascinating and surprising tale. So Brandenburg has its genesis in the Espionage and Sedition Acts of 1917 and 1918, some of which is still in force, by the way, passed during the hysteria of World War I, and the Red Scare that followed, with the support and encouragement of Woodrow Wilson, who of course is a liberal icon. The act, two separate acts, espionage and sedition, made it a federal crime for any citizen in wartime to willfully make any false reports or statements that would interfere with U.S. military operations. It's fine. Or promote the success of its enemies. That's also fine. Now get this. And cause or attempt to cause insubordination, disloyalty, mutiny, refusal of duty in the military or naval forces of the United States, or willfully obstruct recruitment of enlistment in the service, meaning you could not be publicly anti-war. Big penalty was a big fine and maximum of 20 years in prison. Wilson's Justice Department, in the guise of the Attorney General Mitchell Palmer and the youthful head of the Justice Department's Enemy Aliens Registration Section, J. Edgar Hoover, prosecuted almost 2,000 people for some violation of these provisions and deported hundreds of aliens. Some of the prosecutions were very strange. Most seem to involve Jews. So one named Robert Goldstein, a German Jewish immigrant, produced a movie about the Revolutionary War called The Spirit of 76 that depicted British atrocities during the war. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison, commuted to 3 years by Wilson. Why? For harming the war effort, because Britain was an American ally. And the movie, which depicted the atrocities of the Revolutionary War, would tend to generate hostility towards the British. When he was released from prison, he was denied American citizenship. He was deported back to Germany. Some rumors are he was actually killed on Kristallnacht. Another case, the Reverend Clarence Waldron was anti-war. He was sentenced to 20 years in prison for saying more or less that true Christians are not allowed to fight, period. He was convicted of obstructing recruitment efforts. Now, these cases were in the wake of Schenck versus United States, which is famous, very famous for a soundbite we'll get to in a moment, if not for its legal analysis. Charles Schenck was the leader of the Socialist Party. He was anti-war, and he mailed circulars in 1917 urging resistance to the draft on the grounds that it violated the involuntary servitude clause of the 13th Amendment. He said the draft was a monstrous wrong motivated by capitalism. Now, 100 years later, it sounds almost ludicrous that some will be prosecuted for it or that people pay attention to it. He was convicted of insubordination and sedition. He was sentenced to prison. He sued on First Amendment grounds. The court ruled in 1919 unanimously, 9-0, that Schenck was guilty. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote, "We admit that in many places and in ordinary times the defendants, in saying all that was said in the circular, would have been within their constitutional rights. But the character of every act depends upon the circumstances in which it is done. The most stringent protection of free speech would not protect a man in falsely shouting fire in a theater and causing a panic." Well, that latter statement, of course, is famous. It's especially famous for the consistent misquote that you cannot shout fire in a crowded theater. Of course you can, if the theater's on fire. What Holmes said is you can't falsely shout fire in a crowded theater, but you never hear that. Holmes went on to state the legal definition. "The question in every case is whether the words used are used in such circumstances and are of such a nature as to create the clear and present danger that they will bring about the substantive evils that Congress has a right to prevent. It's a question of proximity and degree. When a nation is at war, many things that might be said in time of peace are such a hindrance to its effort that their utterance will not be endured so long as men fight, and that no court could regard them as protected by any constitutional right." And that became the standard. Any statement that will be a clear and present danger to national security was not protected speech. And the court was unanimous, included the Jewish Justice Louis Brandeis. That same day, two other decisions were announced. Same day, Debs versus United States and Froework versus United States. So we all heard of Eugene V. Debs. I mean, the radio station, now defunct WEVD, was named after him. Prominent socialist, Debs made an anti-war speech, Jew, sentenced to 10 years in prison. He lost his right to vote. Now, he was very famous because he'd already run for president 4 times. The last time he ran was in 1920. He was already in prison because of this case, and he ran anyway. Reminded me of Sharansky's joke that the difference between him and other Israeli politicians is that he began his career in prison. He didn't end it there. So Debs ran for president for the 5th time while he was in jail. He won 3.4% of the popular vote, his most ever. I mean, he did better not campaigning and having been convicted than he ever did on the campaign trail last week in the West Virginia primary, the Democratic primary. He had a fellow incarcerated in Texas who won 41% of the Democratic vote to Obama's 59%. Okay, that was Debs. His conviction stood as well. Jacob Froework, the other case, was a pro-German editor of the Missouri Staatszeitung. He wrote 12 anti-war articles in 1917, and the articles were innocuous by today's standards. This is from Holmes' decision. The first is from the articles. "The first begins by declaring it a monumental, inexcusable mistake to send our soldiers to France." Okay, you wouldn't find that today because no one speaks in such multisyllabic words. "Says that it comes no doubt from the great trusts," meaning the evil capitalists. "Later that it appears to be outright murder without serving anything practical. Speaks of the unconquerable spirit and undiminished strength of the German nation, and characterizes its own discourse as words of warning to the American people." Well, the convictions of both Debs and Froework were affirmed. It's another case slightly altered the consensus. in Abrams versus the United States, again 1919, again two Jews were convicted of tossing Yiddish leaflets from a building in New York. The leaflets, in Yiddish, mind you, opposed the sending of American troops to Russia to stop the communist revolution and supported the end to the production of weapons that will be sent to fight the communists. Meaning these two were communists. They wanted Lenin to succeed. They were against any American intervention that would stop that. They were convicted. The court ruled 7-2 that this speech violated the Sedition Act and was not protected as it incited disloyalty. Interestingly, Holmes and Brandeis dissented, saying that in this case there was no clear and present danger. Holmes: now nobody can suppose that the surreptitious publishing of a silly leaflet by an unknown man, I add, in Yiddish, without more, would present any immediate danger that its opinions would hinder the success of the government arms or have any appreciable tendency to do so. That's the clear intent to harm the government, which does not exist here. What about Schenck? What about Froberg? It's the same thing. So now we know years later from the research that after Schenck, Holmes read first an article by and met the legal scholar Zachariah Chaffee Jr., professor of law at Harvard, who had written an article entitled Freedom of Speech in Wartime. And Schenck was very critical of the direction of the court. Holmes was persuaded that his reasoning in Schenck was misguided and dangerous, so he would never retract. Indeed, he affirmed Schenck in the Abrams case, but he undermined it. And Holmes wrote, "But when men have realized that time has upset many fighting faiths, the ultimate good desired is better reached by free trade in ideas, that the best test of truth is the power of the thought to get itself accepted in the competition of the market." From there they got the expression, the marketplace of ideas. "And that truth is the only ground upon which their wishes safely can be carried out. That at any rate is the theory of our Constitution. That, at any rate, is the theory of our Constitution. It is an experiment, as all life is an experiment. Every year, if not every day, we have to wager our salvation upon some prophecy based upon imperfect knowledge. While that experiment is part of our system, I think we should be eternally vigilant against attempts to check the expression of opinions that we loathe and believe to be fraught with death, unless they so imminently threaten immediate interference with the lawful and pressing purposes of the law that an immediate check is required to save the country." Of course, the same could have been applied to Schenck, but the die was cast. Schenck stood as law until after World War II in the case of Terminiello versus Chicago. Arthur Terminiello was a suspended Catholic priest who violated Chicago ordinance against breaching the peace by declaring to a packed auditorium that Hitler was right and that the Jews and the communists would be the downfall of America. He was convicted of that insightful conduct. His conviction was affirmed until the case of the Supremes. Now we're post-war. In a 5-4 decision, a young William O. Douglas wrote that Terminiello's rantings were protected speech, and Douglas cemented his reputation by writing and everything that would come from him the next 30 years. "The vitality of civil and political institutions in our society depends on free discussion. It is only through free debate and free exchange of ideas that government remains responsive to the will of the people and peaceful change is effected. The right to speak freely and to promote diversity of ideas and programs is therefore one of the chief distinctions that sets us apart from totalitarian regimes. Accordingly, a function of free speech under our system of government is to invite dispute. It may indeed best serve its high purpose when it induces a condition of unrest, creates dissatisfaction with conditions as they are, or even stirs people to anger. Speech is often provocative and challenging. It may strike at prejudices and preconceptions and have profound unsettling effects as it presses for acceptance of an idea." Those are the words of Justice Douglas. In other words, fighting words would not be protected, but terminiello's were. There were several dissents. One was the Jewish justice of the time, Felix Frankfurter, who stated the court had never before invalidated a state sentence. He said, freedom of speech undoubtedly means freedom to express views that challenge deep-seated sacred beliefs and to utter sentiments that may provoke resentment. But those indulging in such stuff as that to which this proceeding gave rise are hardly so deserving as to lead this court to single them out as beneficiaries of the first departure from the restrictions that bind this court in reviewing judgments of state courts. And he said, it's odd, what are we talking about here? Life, liberty. Terminiello was fined $100. He says, for $100, we're not going to make law in this case. But he was in the minority, and all this leads to the turbulence of the 1960s and our case of Brandenburg versus Ohio. Clarence Brandenburg was a leader of the Ku Klux Klan. He spoke at a rally near Cincinnati in 1964, the full regalia of the white hoods and the burning crosses and inflammatory words. He denounced the government, all three branches, as devoted to suppressing the Caucasian race. And he said, I quote, personally, I believe the Negro should be returned to Africa, the Jew returned to Israel. That might not be interpreted as racist as much as it's pro-Aliyah. Depends how you look at it. He didn't say Negro, he used the common expression of the time. He also wasn't the greatest Chacham. He called for revengeance against those two groups, the blacks and the Jews. Revengeance is a combination of revenge and vengeance. He made up a word. And their supporters, he called for a march on Washington, and his rally was televised. Brandenburg was arrested. He was charged under state law with criminal syndicalism, that is, advising violence as a means of accomplishing industrial or political reform, and voluntarily assembling with any society group or assemblage of persons formed to teach or advocate the doctrines of criminal syndicalism. It's a fancy way of saying organized crime. Brandenburg was fined $1,000, sentenced to 1 to 10 years in prison. All his appeals were summarily rejected, and his case came to the Supremes. The court ruled 8-0 in a rare per curiam decision, means through the court, the number of concurrences but no one author, that Brandenburg was wrongly convicted, and they reversed. Schenck and the clear and present danger standard was tossed out and a new standard embraced. The only speech that was not entitled, only political speech that was not entitled to First Amendment protection is speech that is intended to promote imminent lawless action and is likely to incite such action, meaning action is unlawful and is bound to happen in a very, very short amount of time. Decision was 8-0. Who disappeared? It was Justice Abe Fortas, the Jewish justice of the time. He had originally drafted an opinion that would have retained the clear and present danger standard with, in a modified form, but he was forced to leave the court. He resigned after a scandal erupted. He accepted a $20,000 retainer to advise a foundation run by another Jew, Louis Wolfson, who was under investigation for securities fraud. Apparently, the allegation was that Wolfson assumed that Fortas, who was very close to Lyndon Baines Johnson, would intervene with the Justice Department to stop any indictment of Wolfson. Didn't work. In the end, Wolfson was indicted, spent a year in prison. Fortas had to resign, and his opinion was discarded. Now, here the court ruled, it was 8-0, that the Ohio statute purports to punish mere advocacy and to forbid on pain of criminal punishment assembly with others merely to advocate the described type of action. Meaning, shouldn't be any problem with someone calling for violence, revengeance, a march on Washington, as long as it's not imminent. He says it, but no one is putting his plans to fruition immediately. In a concurrence, Justice Douglas strove to protect the falsely shouting fire in a theater. It's a great line. You don't want to lose it. So he said, this is a classic case where speech is brigaded with action, meaning you shout fire falsely, people are going to run out. They are indeed inseparable, and a prosecution can be launched for the overt acts actually caused. Apart from rare instances of that kind, speech is, I think, immune from prosecution. Well, Brandenburg has remained the law of the land since 1969. And the truth is, it's been responsible for much of the unpleasantness in American life for the last four decades plus. Just the dozens of cases that refer to it, just to take a few famous ones. In the infamous Skokie case in 1977, the Cook County Court prohibited the American Nazi Party from marching through Skokie wearing their uniforms and carrying their swastika flag. So you remember the ACLU sued on their behalf based on Brandenburg, and the Supreme Court ordered the Illinois Court to find a way to allow them to march. And they did, although in fact the march was eventually moved to Chicago, not Skokie. In that case, interestingly, Berger, Rehnquist, and Stewart dissented on procedural grounds. There was no final judgment in Illinois, so it wasn't ripe for court review, but they plunged in and they permitted it. More recently, and just as troubling for non-First Amendment absolutists, Brandenburg was the implicit basis of the decision in Snyder versus Phelps. That's last year, the infamous Westboro Baptist Church case. The preacher of the church, a nut named Fred Phelps, stood a few hundred yards from a military funeral. Snyder's son Matthew was killed in Iraq, and together with his church picketed the funeral, chanting that America is doomed because of its tolerance of homosexuality, and carrying signs like, "Thank God for dead soldiers." Snyder sued for intentional infliction of emotional distress and related claims, and he won almost $11 million. Phelps appealed, and the court reversed 8-1, finding that Snyder had not actually seen the protesters at the funeral, but only later on television, and that they were on the sidewalk debating, essentially, a public issue. The majority opinion was written by Chief Justice Roberts, and he ended. Speech is powerful. It can stir people to action, move them to tears of both joy and sorrow, and as it did here, inflict great pain. On the facts before us, we cannot react to that pain by punishing the speaker. As a nation, we have chosen a different course, to protect even hurtful speech on public issues, to ensure that we do not stifle public debate. Well, the vote was 8-1. The one was Justice Alito, Samuel Alito, New Jersey's own Samuel Alito, who filed a very powerful but lone dissent. And he said some of it's plausible from a moral perspective. Our profound national commitment to free and open debate is not a license for the vicious verbal assault that occurred in this case. Petitioner Albert Snyder is not a public figure. He's simply a parent whose son, Marine Lance Corporal Matthew Snyder, was killed in Iraq. Mr. Snyder wanted what is surely the right of any parent who experiences such an incalculable loss, to bury his son in peace. But respondents, members of the Westboro Baptist Church, deprived him of that elementary right. So he added, they have an absolute right to disseminate their opinions. I quote, "It does not follow, however, that they may intentionally inflict severe emotional injury on private persons at a time of intense emotional sensitivity by launching vicious verbal attacks that make no contribution to the public debate." Alito was especially outraged that they made, during the protest, public reference to the Snyders at the funeral, saying, "God blessed you, Mr. and Mrs. Snyder, with a resource, and his name was Matthew. He was an arrow in your quiver. In thanks to God for the comfort the child could bring you, you had a duty to prepare that child to serve the Lord his God. Period. You did just the opposite. You raised him for the devil," meaning the American government. Alito said, "Free speech does not allow brutalization, verbal brutalization of others." We lost. That's where we are today. Earlier, going back to the 60s, in a harbinger of Brandenburg, the court dealt with another chacham, apparently another Jew, a Californian named Paul Robert Cohn, walked into the L.A. County Courthouse in April 1968 wearing a jacket adorned with the words, "Bleep the draft, fill in the blank." He was anti-draft, like Schenck was. He was arrested, convicted of disturbing the peace, sentenced to 30 days in jail. The court ruled 5-4 in Cone versus California that such speech was protected. And reversed. Justice Harlan, one man's vulgarity is another's lyric. The dissent ruled this was not speech, but conduct. Three people can argue that arcana, but there's no doubt, being in a world where this is now very prevalent, there's no doubt that it has lowered the discourse and the culture even more. Brandenburg remains the law, and almost any speech short of falsely shouting fire in a crowded theater or calling for immediate violence is protected. Any attack, no matter how vicious, and in the case of a public figure, as we saw in New York Times versus Sullivan, even a false and defamatory but not offered with malice, will also be protected. Well, what does the Torah say about all this? The right to criticize the government, despite all the variations in application over the decades, is fundamental to American life. Criticism leads to justice, leads to reform, and is the very basis of freedom, even if it can be abused. Democracy is nurtured in the marketplace of ideas. From a Torah perspective, speech is not an absolute, but a limited right, if it's a right at all. The emphasis is placed on not the joys of free speech, but on the consequences, the potentially harmful effects of speech on oneself and on others. And you see, Chazal praised silence much more than they did speech. Gemara says in Megillah, Daf Yuches Amud Aleph, Mila b'sela, mashtuka b'terein. If a word is worth one coin, silence can be purchased with two. It's more expensive. At the end of the first parak in Avos, Shimon b'no Omer, kol yamai gadalti b'en ha-chachamim, lo matos l'guf tov el-shtika. He said, I grew up amongst the sages, I never found something as healthy for the body as silence. And there the Rambam distinguishes between five types of speech. Mitzvah, Asur, Maus, Ahuv, Mutar. Mitzvah, commanded speech, like Torah, like Tefillah. Asur, like Lashon Hara, like Rechilus. Maus, reprehensible speech, without any virtue, like the chattering of the masses. Includes, Eich minag melech ploni ba'armono. How does so-and-so live in his palace? Or what did Romney do during high school? That's Maus, how the king acts in the palace. Ahuv, beloved speech, about ideas, about values, about midos, praising praiseworthy people. And mutter, permissible speech about work, food, drink, etc., that the exalted person limits. That doesn't seem to allow for much government opposition or ridicule. So what about political speech? How is a Jew supposed to relate to the king, to the government, to an authority figure, especially if they're lacking in integrity or rife with corruption? The parameters of Jewish law are different because the objectives of Jewish life are different. Our goals are not liberty or pursuit of happiness or material success, but rather service of God and holiness. So every aspect of Jewish life is evaluated from that one prism. Does it impede or enhance one's avodas Hashem? So within that framework, we understand the need for a king as well, and the concomitant limitations on criticizing the king, or the Sanhedrin, or the leadership. Rambam says in Hilchos Melachim Perek Beis, Kavod Gadol Nohagim B'Melach, we give great honor to the king, who Mesim Elohim of the year B'Leif Kol Adam, and the king instills fear and dread in the heart of every person. Shenemar, Som Tasim Alecha Melach, Shetahe Emaso Alecha, we're supposed to live in dread, in reverence, in awe of the king. We revere the king. We fear him as well. We can't sit on his throne. We can't borrow his scepter. We can't marry his widow. The king cuts his hair every day. He must always look royal, because he too has to show honor to the king, to the institution of Malchus. The king is the symbol of the nation. He's the unifying element of the nation. This is Davin the base medrash, if you want to Davin. And he's really the personification of the nation. The king's primary goal is unity, to project power, laharim dasa emes, to elevate the true faith, to provide stability, continuity. The king can't be contradicted. That's why the king cannot sit on the Sanhedrin. He cannot be called by his name. He cannot have jokes made in his presence, which to us is... the presence is supposed to be made fun of and sitting here, in fact. In short, the Aruch HaShulchan HaOsid, Rabbi Chil Michel, is a separate sefer that I have at home. I've looked at it maybe three times in 30 years. The future Aruch HaShulchan, dealing with events in the future, Hilchos Malachim Siman Ayin, Sif Aleph. I only saw this because it was quoted by Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Bar Ilan in his classic work. Aruch HaShulchan writes that Melech Basu V'dom Nismanim Epi Melech Malchem Malachem HaKadosh Baruch Hu. A king of flesh and blood is appointed by the King of Kings, by God Himself. V'lev Melech V'sar B'yan Hashem. The heart of the king and the officers are in God's hands. V'chomi Shemoreid B'melech B'maso B'machshava. Whoever rebels against the king in deed or in thought, Nitrad Mishnei Olamos Me'olam Hazeh U'me'olam Abba. He is forced from two worlds, this and the next. The oilahem ulanafshosam, woe to them and their souls. The gormim ra l'klal Yisrael, they cause great harm to the Jewish people. And we're taught, in Hilchos Malachim Pergim Halacha Ches, kol hamoreid b'melech Yisrael, yesh l'melech reshus l'hargo. Whoever rebels against the king of Israel, the king has the permission to kill him. He could even, afil gazar lecha misharam sheyel chumakam ploni v'lo halach. Even if he tells someone, you must go there, and the guy doesn't go. Or he tells someone, you can't leave your home, and he does, chayav misa. V'imratza l'harago, yehareg, if he wants to kill him, he can. Shenemar kol ish asher yamre espicha. Any person who disobeys your word. V'chein kol hamivazes hamelech. Anyone who mocks the king. Or hamecharfo, or blasphemes him. Yesh l'melech reshus l'harago, kishimi ben gera. The king has the right, the permission to kill him, like David had the right to kill Shimi. That is an absolute ruler. But here's the catch. It's not widely known, but the king of Israel was not an absolute ruler. And he had his power circumscribed in very meaningful ways, what we would call today checks and balances. Firstly, the king needed to be appointed and approved by the Sanhedrin. And he has no power in the Sanhedrin. The king is not consulted on religious matters, doesn't give psak halacha. He has no general role to play in economic or social policy. His real powers are limited to taxation for domestic needs and for the conduct of war. Even his war powers are subject to Sanhedrin approval. The king doesn't own the land of Israel. He can't give it away. It's not his to give away. In large part, he's a figurehead, except he has this martial power. Real governance comes, though, from the Sanhedrin and from the local councils. Secondly, he's admonished to be humble. He has to carry a Sefer Torah with him at all times, to remind himself that God is above him. He's limited in the number of wives he can have, number of horses he can have, the pursuit of wealth, so he doesn't uplift himself above his brethren. That's a ubiquitous concern. The king can even be tried and given malchus. Rambam, again in Perek Gimel, now Halacha Zayin. Kfar be'arnu shemalchei beis David, donin osan u'me'idin aleihem. The kings of the house of David, they could be tried and people could testify against them for wrongdoing. Not malchei Yisrael, the kings of Israel, the separate gzera, mipnei shaliban gaspa, and v'yavamin adavat takola v'hefzed aladaz, because they were not as righteous, not as pious. Most of them were Rishayim, so therefore they felt it better just to desist and not bring them before the Sanhedrin. Kings of Israel, different status, they weren't fully endorsed, they governed with an attitude, so they were deferred to more, except they could not sit in the Azara, only Malchus Beis David could. In summary, the Rambam says, Perek Beis, Halacha Vav, Hilchos Malachim, Kiderach Shecholak Lo HaKosuv, Akavah HaGadol, just like he was given great honor, V'chayev HaKol B'chavod, everybody has to honor the king, Kach Sivo Lios Libo B'kirbo Shofol V'cholol, so too is commanded that he should be humble, his heart should be empty, meaning he shouldn't be haughty. V'leinai Gassus Levi Yisrael Yosemidai, shouldn't be too supercilious over other Jews. V'yachonin Marachim Atan Gedolim, he should be compassionate to the small and the great. V'yetzei V'yov V'chafetzei V'tov Asam, he should try to engender good feelings, look after their welfare. When he speaks to the Kol, he should speak in a soft tone. Ula olam yisnaid ba'anova yisera. He should always conduct himself with great, excessive humility. The rise mi Moshe Rabbeinu. The yizbol tircha masom utzlosom mikitzvam. He has to tolerate their burdens, their complaints, their anger. The king is put in a certain place. He's above everyone from our perspective, but not from his perspective. Thirdly, there was a method, at least in theory, of dealing with corrupt kings. I say in theory because the more depraved kings, Ovdei Avodah Zarah, murderers, could be dealt with only by God. But the task of rebuking the king fell not to media elitists or late-night comedians, but to the Novi Hashem. The king was not immune from criticism. On the contrary, the Novi made his career rebuking the king. Nasan, Eliyahu, Elisha, Yeshayahu, and others. The Pasuk in Tehillim, Kuf Mem Aleph, Yehelmeini Tzadik Chesed V'Yochicheni. David HaMelech said, let the righteous one strike me with chesed and rebuke me. Rashi says, Tov li shochicheni v'yasreini novi emes v'tzedek shekol mahalomo v'tochachto chesed. Better that I should be reproved, criticized by the prophet of truth and justice, all his blows, all his reproofs are kindness. And many poskim held that the Melech Yisrael could be deposed, removed from office for malfeasance, whether it was taking property that was not his or for killing people unjustly. It's so interesting. Why didn't Achav just kill Navos HaYisraeli instead? Why go to the charade of having false witnesses accuse him of blasphemy and then seize his vineyard after he was executed? So the Radak there says, Ki af ligzol hakerem lohoyo lakoach. He didn't have the power to seize his vineyard. Ki achav v'izavel. Afal pi shehoyu resham hayu l'shamayim lavad avad azorah. Even though they were exceedingly wicked, idolaters. Avalam hayu hargim v'gozl shlobim mishpat. If they would rob and steal unjustly, hayu Yisrael mordim bo. The people would have rebelled. Ki lo hayu menichem melech aleihem im lo yamed eretz v'mishpat. They would not tolerate a king who did injustice. Avodah Zarah, that they accepted. The Radak says only 7,000 Jews who hadn't bowed down to Baal, so they were the minority. But the people would not have tolerated rank injustice. So too, a king could be removed if his policies endanger the nation. Such a king is a Rodev. Indeed, even though we're very careful about Morib Malchus, if a Melech wrongfully pursues someone, the king is a Rodev, and the pursued has the right to kill him. This we know from David HaMelech, the Gemara Brachos, Daf Samach Beis and Beis. Omer lo David l'shol, David said to Shol, Min HaTorah ben haregato. Min HaTorah, I could kill you. You're liable to be killed. Shaharei Rodev ato, you're a Rodev. VaTorah Omra, Bo lahargecho ashkem lahargo. Torah says, someone comes to kill you, rise up and kill them first. The decision to depose the king is made by the Beis Din HaGadol. But Rav Herzog wrote that if a king is disfavored by a majority of Jews, Rov Yisrael, he'll be removed from office. So in that sense, the people rule, or at least there's a very finely calibrated balance of power between the people and the king. Thus, the king had to retain the trust and confidence of the people that he would always act l'shem shemayim and use his capital powers judiciously and rarely. And note what the Rambam said. The king has the right, he has permission, He can. It doesn't mean that he must. In fact, if he did, it was sure to anger the people. So the king cannot waive his kavod. Melech shemochel akvodo, ein kvodo mochel. King cannot waive his honor, but he can choose not to execute even people who disobey. Now the king's honor cannot be waived for several reasons. According to the Rambam, without kavod, he's not the king. Baran says in the Drashos, Yud Aleph, that his honor is the honor of the people, since he's a representative of them. He can't waive their honor. The Neri says the Ema will be gone if the king waives his honor. So the Ema, the awe, the reverence for his majesty is gone as well. I have to tell you, I'm old-fashioned, but it bothers me no end the last 10, 15 years when you see presidents and candidates walking around without suits and ties, as if they're trying to blend in with the population. If you want to blend in, so get someone else from the population. But you have a little dignity for what you're doing and not feel you have to run to every comedian, every talk show, because it does debase the office. There's no Ema anymore once you get to know these people. And it's also an affront to God. The king represents God in the world. The Medrash says in Bereishis Rabbah, "Kol hameis panav b'melech ilu meis panav b'shechina." A person who acts impudently to the king, it's like he's acting impudently to Hashem himself. But the king who sins is chastised, like any Jew. Why was Avner punished? Avner should have rebuked Shaul for murdering Novi Arkonim, and he didn't. And Gemara says in Sanhedrin Kuf Aleph Amid Beis, Yerovah ben Nevat merited being the king because he rebuked Shlomo. But he was punished because he rebuked him in public. There are those who argue that there's no obligation to honor a Melech Rasha based on the Gemara Sanhedrin of Chafam and Aleph, that he lacks all the prerogatives of the king, but it's not entirely clear. Other, you see, even David respected Shaul, didn't want to, and he felt, he was even criticized for tearing his cloak. But others say that even he represents the Jewish people in the world, and therefore should not be abused, and that, as we hear in other contexts, it's the office being honored, and not necessarily the person. We have examples of rebels in Jewish life, none of them too inspiring. Avshalom, Achitofel, Adoniyahu. In fact, I can't think of a Jewish revolutionary who's praised. Conversely, ingrained in the Jewish DNA is deference to loyalty, a deference to royalty rather, even non-Jewish, despite the plethora of Jews in the ranks of the anarchists and the anti-government activists. They're not acting as Jews moved by the Torah, but according to other values and agendas. We follow still Yirmiyahu's admonition, V'dirshu Shlomo Yerusha Iglesias from Shama, seek the peace of the city to which you have been exiled, and pray for it, Ki b'Shlomo Yelechem Shalom. In the peace of the city, you'll find your own peace. In summary, there's something quaint about notions of respect for authority. In America, it really was destroyed by the 60s and will likely never be regained. Politics is much darker now, and politics was always dirty, but it's much darker now because of the reach of the media. You know, just last week, news came out, not that I take sides, but news came out that Obama himself has an enemies list where major donors to Romney are exposed on the presidential or the campaign website, and the full weight of government, investigators, internet researchers are brought to bear. I read the other day the story of Frank Vandersloot, who's a millionaire from Idaho, who now finds his business being targeted, and people prying, trying to get his divorce records out of the courts in Idaho to find some dirt on him because he gave $1 million to a Romney PAC. It's very rough. But there's something that is quaint and attractive about admiring and respecting, even revering the king and allowing the officialdom to challenge him when necessary. The early cases, Schenck and Debs, were at least activists in causes and even prominent people. The more recent cases, Cohn and Brandenburg and Phelps and the Nazis, were basically nobodies who exploited the First Amendment either to be childish or to be provocative or to be cruel to other people. And therein lies the dilemma of the First Amendment. It comes initially to protect political speech as directed against the government, but it is forced to permit much nastiness and viciousness and spitefulness that harms average citizens and doesn't affect the government at all. So Torah warns us about speech, to where that speech can edify or coarsen public discourse, and it admonishes us that even more important than a right to speak is forethought about what is or should be spoken. Silence is often golden. If we look at our cases, Schenck and Debs and Abrams all violated halacha because the melech has the right to wage war and conscript soldiers for the cause. But in fact, they can bring their objections to the king or to the Sanhedrin. They just cannot oppose the king's decision publicly once it's made. Similar, in some respects, to Zakei Mamre, who's entitled to his opinion against the Sanhedrin, he just can't preach it publicly. It almost goes without saying that a moron like Cohn cannot pollute the public domain with his obscenities in a Torah system, nor can American Nazis with their hatred that Brandenburg does not have the right to advocate violence against the government or blacks or Jews, even if nothing is imminent. Even if lawless action is not imminent, and that Minister Phelps should live in eternal shame for mocking someone else's death, but the Torah gives us an inner compass that makes those cases pretty obvious. Neither system is perfect. Maybe said a better way, if I'm not stoned, the Torah system is perfect. But in practice it becomes imperfect because many kings of Israel weren't perfect, and mankind itself isn't perfect. In a perfect world, so we'd remind the people, the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, Daf Kuf Yud Amar Aleph, Amar Rav Yossi, Kol HaCholek Al Malchus Beis David, Roy LaKishon Nachosh, a person who argues, who challenges the kingdom of David, he should be bitten by a snake. An esteemed monarchy benefits all of us, and we remind the rulers as well to respect and to honor the people. It's that mutual respect that today is missing in America, and that Brandenburg fosters, that should be the very heart of the relationship of the governor and the governed in the Torah state. I thank you all very much. We have one or two sessions left.